when I went in to see Minnis the first time. And
okay, good evening, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is Tuesday evening, March 14th.
It is that.
Pi Day.
It is that. That sounds good.
For the mathematician.
Yes.
And I'm going to bring to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
And it is. Do they know it's Pi Day today?
Yeah. And the first order of business is not related to the topic that we're talking about tonight, but I need to, for my committee on the House side, carry over the public hearing for House Bill 2131. So we've done that.
Okay, so I'm going to open up tonight's informational meeting. Colleagues and members of the audience, the focus of tonight's meeting is what we're calling Carbon Markets 101. So this is our chance to really delve into the issue that we heard about. I think when we met jointly a couple of weeks ago, we heard a report from DEQ on giving us the report that was commissioned by the legislature last year on how Oregon could move in a similar direction to California's Cap and Invest program. And it went into a lot of detail about what that program is like in California, what it could look like here. It was a very good report, but we had very little time to press, to ask questions and to get details. And tonight is going to be our chance to do that. In addition, we'll be hearing from Jason Eisendorfer from the PUC, who is going to talk to us about how energy regulation kind of fits into this arena. And then we'll also be hearing from Sean Penrith from the Climate Trust, who's going to share with us their perspectives and their understanding on how such markets work. I will say that next week we're going to be, so tonight is Carbon Markets 101, next week is going to be 201. We're going to be hearing from some of our partners, or our, not our partners, but our counterparts in California, in Quebec, in Ontario, about how the programs are working or how they're designed to work in those entities. And we're also going to be hearing from our friends at Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association, giving us their initial thoughts about the downsides as well as the upsides of carbon pricing. So that's just to give you some suspense for next week. So let's have all three of our presenters come up together. I think that's the most efficient way. Colin is going to start us off, I think, and then Jason and then Sean. Colin, if you could introduce yourself and introduce what it is you're going to tell us.
Absolutely.
And colleagues, please feel, if this is okay with you, Colin, feel free to, when you have questions, just let's jump in, especially for clarifications. This is all about getting us to a better understanding of these programs.
Great. Thank you. Chair Denbrough, Chair Helm, members of the committees, for the record, my name is Colin McConaughey. I am the Senior Climate Policy Advisor at the Department of Environmental Quality. As Chair Denbrough mentioned, I'm going to provide, I guess as we are calling it, a 101 on cap and trade, along with information here from Jason Eisendorfer at the PUC and Sean Penrith at the Climate Trust. And what I'm going to try to do here is walk through what, in the course of our study that Chair Denbrough just mentioned, what appeared to us to be the primary components of a cap-and-trade program. It's a fairly complex policy, at least at first blush, and there are a lot of different elements, and each of those elements have some options. So I'm going to walk through each of these key elements of the program, what are some of the options for designing those elements, and some of the implications of choosing one option over another. Apologies. This slide is probably familiar to folks. We used it a couple weeks ago in our presentation on the study the DEQ had conducted.
I don't recognize it at all, Colin, okay. Actually. No, we're not. Oh, there it is.
I could keep you in suspense. Could say anything. So what this slide is attempting to do is just visually show how a cap and trade program works. And it starts up there at the top with those blue lines indicating a cap or an overall limit on emissions. And actually, I would start with saying, you know, what a cap and trade program first does is identify the sources of emissions, or what the state or entity designing the program does is design or identify the sources of emissions to be covered by this cap or overall limit on emissions. And once that once those sources are identified and that cap is established, then the state issues allowances, which are essentially small permits to emit greenhouse gas emissions. They typically take the form of one ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. So if the state has set a cap at 40 million tons, then it has 40 million allowances to issue into the system. And I'll explain each of these parts, the cap, which sources are covered, and allowance issuance here in just a moment. But just so we're all kind of thinking about the same thing, starting from the same point of reference, cap and trade is an overall limit on emissions from a collection of emission sources. Those sources receive allowances from the state to continue to emit, but those allowances are only issued up to that limit, up to that cap. And those allowances can then, once the state issues them, either through selling them at auction or directly allocating them to covered entities in the program, once those are issued, those allowances can subsequently be bought and sold, which is the trading element and also the marketplace that is established by the program. So with that, then here we have essentially a table of contents for my next several slides. These are those key elements I mentioned a moment ago that we identified in the course of our study, the key elements of a cap and trade program. And I'll walk through each of these. I don't need to run through the list right now, but you'll see each of these here over the next seven or eight slides. And before I start on that, I just wanted to remind committee members also of the considerations that legislature identified in your direction to DEQ for us to look into these considerations in particular as we identified how a cap and trade program might be designed and work in Oregon. And just starting there from the top, the first and perhaps most obvious consideration for a program like this is what would be its effect on greenhouse gas emissions here in Oregon. And secondly, the second consideration legislature identified is how would the program need to be designed in order to link with other cap and trade programs? We know there's a cap and trade, there's currently linked programs between California and Quebec. Ontario has just set up a system that they intend to link to that system. That system is collectively known as the Western Climate Initiative, or WCI, so you may hear me say either of those terms. Then thirdly, the interaction between existing programs we already have here in place in Oregon, like the Renewable Portfolio Standard or our Clean Fuels Program, the interaction between those programs and the introduction of a cap and trade program. What would that interaction look like? Would it be a graceful or complementary interaction, or would it be more of a cumbersome or duplicative interaction? And I think Jason in particular is going to dig a little deeper there into the interaction between a cap and trade program and the many regulations we already have in place in the utility sector. Second to last bullet there, and another, I think, obvious consideration when figuring out whether a program like this would fit for Oregon is the potential impacts to businesses and to the economy as a whole. And especially what we looked at in our study and what I think programs like this are chiefly concerned with here is what a term called leakage, which is really the effect of any kind of tax or fee that a jurisdiction imposes on businesses can induce a pressure for that business to move to another jurisdiction that isn't charging that fee or tax to avoid paying it. So it's not something unique or specific to cap and trade or pricing carbon, but it is certainly something that can arise from a policy like this. And that really is a significant concern because it not only does it impact the state by losing the jobs and that economic output, it also would theoretically just shift those emissions elsewhere. So there wouldn't even be a net reduction in emissions necessarily. And then finally, legislature directed DEQ to consider the potential distinct effects on rural communities and disadvantaged populations. I think with the understanding that rural communities and disadvantaged populations would feel the effects of a program like this somewhat differently than their more wealthy or urban counterparts. Rural communities tend to have less viable transportation alternatives. Biking and walking may not be as realistic in those areas. Transit options are fewer. They also, some rural communities tend to be less economically diverse. And so any impact on one or two major employers in those areas might have a more acute effect on those communities. And then, of course, low-income households in particular tend to feel the effect of higher energy prices more acutely, as they tend to spend greater portions of their household income on energy. So those were the considerations that legislature directed DEQ to consider. And there are also some considerations I'll try to come back to here in the following slides as I discuss some of these options. What are their implications in any one of these five areas? So starting here, this is a pie chart here of Oregon's statewide greenhouse gas emissions. It's probably not something, I'm sure it isn't something folks have seen because it was just created today, but it's what it does is it breaks out Oregon's emissions a little differently than how you've seen them broken out either in DEQ's annual greenhouse gas inventory or in reports from the Oregon Global Warming Commission. The reason for these little different wedges is that what we've attempted to do here is break up the sources of emissions to allow the cut lines to fall where we believe the boundary between sources of emissions that could feasibly be covered by a cap and trade program in Oregon from those sources of emissions that likely couldn't or realistically wouldn't be feasible to cover with a cap and trade program. This slide then shades in the areas, those wedges of the pie that we believe are sources of emissions that could be feasibly covered. And what you see there is that by our estimation, about 83% of Oregon's statewide emissions could realistically be covered there. The unshaded sources, that 17% that remains, the reason we're saying that those likely could not be covered are that they are either small, so they fall below what we believe is likely to be a threshold that we would use, what we've seen in legislation that's been proposed this session and last session, and what we've seen in other jurisdictions implementing programs like this. Typically, that threshold falls around 25,000 metric tons. So some of the sources in that 17% simply fall below that threshold. Other sources are simply too diffuse or too difficult to quantify reliably enough to subject to a program like this. This is really important where we're the distinction between what we think is feasible versus not is important because one of the recommendations that we made in our study is that the scope of the program should be set as broadly as possible. This was something that was a pretty easy conclusion to come to simply because of the prevalence in academic literature and in policy documents from jurisdictions that have considered or developed a program like this, that a cap-and-trade program is most effective if it covers as many sources of emissions as possible. That opens up the possibility for the greatest number of least-cost emission reductions under that cap to be available to the system. And so it moderates the price and again, frees up the most amount of least-cost emission reductions to be achieved by the program. So essentially what we're saying when we say that what we found in the course of our study is that a program like this should cover as many sources of emissions as possible is to try to cover as close to that 83% as possible.
So, Colin, those areas that are not included, like agriculture and waste, are those not covered in the programs that other jurisdictions have?
That's correct. That's our understanding that those WCI jurisdictions, California, Quebec, and Ontario, are, at least for the most part, is from what we could tell, are not covering those sources of emissions for the reason I mentioned, chiefly that in particular with agriculture, the emissions are difficult to quantify with the same rigor and reliability that you really need to cover them with a program like this.
Thank you.
Yeah. And what you'll hear about in a minute from me, I should add, and perhaps in more detail a little bit from Sean, is that one option of extending the reach of a program like this into that unshaded area is the use of offsets to basically credit the reductions that are occurring in those unshaded areas to the extent that they can be reliably. If there is a project that can be introduced that can reliably quantify those emissions with sufficient rigor and show that those reductions are occurring, a program like this can credit that, and those offset credits can be issued into circulation and be used much like the allowances.
Yes, Senator Roblin.
So one of the first groups of people who got into the carbon market had to do with agriculture and non-till agriculture and trading some of that stuff, Chicago and other places. Is that outside of this now, or are they still doing their own trade kinds of things, or is it pretty much gone now? It's gone. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Sean. Okay, if there's no more questions here, I'll move on to the next area. This is stringency, which really just refers to the relationship of where the state is setting that cap to the sources of emissions covered by the cap. So the greater the it's really the relationship of the supply of allowances that the state is issuing into the system and into the market relative to the demand from those covered sources to continue emitting. So where the state sets this cap in relation to those sources, particularly those sources are covering a majority of Oregon's state greenhouse gas emissions, where that cap is set, of course, has direct bearing then on the greenhouse gas reductions achieved by the program and its ability to meet the state's greenhouse gas or assure that the state is on track to meet its state greenhouse gas reduction goals. That being, again, reminding you that was one of the key considerations for us to look into is how can a program like this be designed to achieve those goals? Well, it's obvious, but one of the ways to design it is then to align the cap on a trajectory with those goals. But it isn't quite that simple. There are some other considerations we need to think about, which is if we're not covering all of our emissions, if we're only covering about 80% of our emissions, are we doing something else in those other areas, in those other 17% or so of emissions, to assure that those emissions are also reduced, that they essentially do their share? And so then we simply set the cap to along the line such that the covered sources, sources covered by this program do their share as well. If not, if we don't think there's reason to believe that those uncovered sources of emissions are going to be able to reduce in sufficient quantity, then perhaps that if the chief consideration is designing this program to assure achievement of our goals, then perhaps the cap would need to be set more stringently to assure that those covered sources do more than their share to kind of pick up the slack. So that's the one of the considerations there. The other, I mentioned there in one of the sub-bullets, the alignment of the trajectory. So we only have a few goals, a few milestones that the legislature has set. The next one coming up is to be 10% below 1990 and 2020, and then the final one is to be 75% below 1990 and 2050. So what's the line in between there? Is it just a linear progression, or is it convex or concave, meaning we would do more reductions in the early years and less in the out years, or vice versa? So those are things to consider. What's also really important to consider, what we found in the course of our study here, is that stringency is the primary consideration for other jurisdictions to allow a new one to link, that we would need to have a very similar level of stringency as those other programs that we've mentioned in the WCI system. Because otherwise, the introduction of Oregon into that system, if we have, a less stringent program, we would be softening that market. We would be kind of reducing the overall stringency of that linked program. Probably not by much, since Oregon's a relatively small share of those linked economies, but nonetheless, there's strong desire from those jurisdictions to ensure that any new jurisdiction linking with it has a similar level of stringency.
Actually, I have a question around that, Colin. So one of the things that we heard when we heard the Global Warming Commission report was that our goals may well be inadequate under changing assumptions about climate change. How are our current goals similar to those of the other entities within the Western Climate Initiative, mm-hmm. or do we have to make changes to align with them? Would we, if that's where we wanted to go?
Chair Dembro, it's a great question, one we asked ourselves very early on, knowing that this relative stringency was an important question. And what we found is that we, in that long-term goal I just mentioned, to be 75% below 1990 in 2050, is similar. It's not quite as stringent as the 80% reduction that California and Ontario are seeking. I'm not sure that Quebec has a 2050 goal as well. What we see in those other jurisdictions is more interim milestones, in particular 2030, that we don't have. So, you know, if we that's where we need perhaps to make an assumption about what kind of trajectory between 2020 and 2050 we would want to make to line up perhaps with those interim 2030 goals. To the question about whether our goals match the latest science, I think that would be a conversation we'd also want to have, just speculating here with the other jurisdictions, if we were to all want to adjust our goals to match the latest science or not. But I think that would be something we'd want to explore with them, and perhaps a question for them when they're up here next week.
Great, thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the value of Oregon's participation or not in these larger programs would be of interest. It's not enough just to point at a goal or somebody else's goal. The question would be, what do we bring to the table as a state by joining other folks? I have a feeling that these programs are enhanced dramatically if a state chooses to join or not. And I would like to know the measure of that value, because I'm sure it has some value, and I'd like to know what that is before we run headlong into these kinds of arrangements. So tell us what that value is, and give us the breakdown of it, because I'm sure there's lots of pieces of value that are more interesting, perhaps, as a small state in compared to California or Washington, British Columbia, whoever has these arrangements. So I mean, you must have done that analysis, because we wouldn't just jump into this arrangement without knowing what we're getting or giving away by joining up. Well, who's doing that analysis for us is probably the better way to put it.
Chairs, Representative Benz, if you're referring to what is the value of us joining to those other jurisdictions, or value, just clarifying question, value to us for us joining, or value to those other jurisdictions of us joining, the latter?
Yeah, if I may follow up, let me make it a little clearer. So as you look at these arrangements, these market arrangements, the more the merrier, the better the system works if you have more states than just one. Mm-hmm. It works at all kinds of levels better. That means we have a value if we join. These things are really complicated. I have learned that over the 10 years I've been listening to these kind of presentations. And usually I have to go out and find experts to tell me exactly what I'm doing and what I'm giving away. You guys are experts. But this is big business. I mean, this is the real deal. I spent an hour on the phone this morning with the folks down in California talking about the low carbon fuel standard credit market. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. But this is one of dozens of calls I've made on that particular issue. So my question to you is, who are we working with on these billion-dollar issues that provides us with the insight I'm sure we are going to need if we're going to make these kind of decisions? Mm-hmm. Where's the long list? I'm sure you have it. This is what we're here for, to kind of learn about these things.
Chairs, Representative Benz, I appreciate the clarification. I'm not sure I do have that long list that you're describing, although I'm still not quite sure I understand what that list would entail. A couple things do come to mind, though, is the benefit that we would bring to those other jurisdictions. You'll recall I mentioned a moment ago on the issue of scope and the number of how many emissions to cover, and our clear finding that there's value in covering as many emissions as possible. Well, having another jurisdiction join that linked system broadens its reach, and again brings with it potentially new lower cost emission reductions into that linked system. So the bigger and broader that linked system can become, theoretically anyway, the more cost-effective of a solution of overall reducing global greenhouse gas emissions that system can provide. So that is essentially, I think, the first thing that comes to my mind as far as what we offer to those folks, to those jurisdictions in California, Quebec, and Ontario.
So just to clarify, so the more trading partners you have, the more trading options you're going to have.
Chair Denver, that's a better way to put it than I did. Yes.
So what I'm trying to say here is, when we get into these great big complex matters, for example, when I was working on the Columbia River crossing, I realized that the type of insight that was necessary for a mega project was missing. Mm-hmm. And it had not been brought to bear at the front end of the project 12, 15 years ago. That's why I'm asking, what kind of help are we getting as a state to advise us on how to do the right thing? Where is that? Because these are billion-dollar issues, multi-billion-dollar issues. In fact, they're far more important than that when we look at all, when we talk about climate in general. So where is that? Is it just us? Are we it? Or do we have other folks that are helping us out? Or do we need it?
Chair, Representative Benz, I this may be more parochial than the big picture you're describing, but as a practical matter, how the advice and the assistance and collaboration and that we would get to design and implement a program like this would come from those partner jurisdictions. Already, in fact, has. We've learned a lot already just looking at those systems. So I have a slide here later on the how this program would be administered, and there the administration would benefit a great deal from those systems already in place that are administering those programs. But I recognize that's not getting to the bigger picture of I think what you're asking, who's helping us maybe get to our figure out the best path to get to our goals, and I think there's a lot to be learned looking at other jurisdictions like California, but I guess to some degree that's up to us to figure out how we want to do that.
Jump in. Yes. Can I jump in real quick?
Rappel. Yeah,
please. So, Colin, I want to be careful here, I appreciate digging down on questions, which is great. If these questions are beyond the scope of what DEQ was asked to do with this study, just say so,
mm-hmm.
because I think that's valid, and if you don't have the answers now, that's fine, and we need to get at that, and I think they're good questions. But if you don't have them, that's fine. Let us know, because we do need to go dig a little deeper and find out where those advantages are and exactly what they are. Mm-hmm. And I do recognize that the scope of work that we gave you in a budget note last session was limited.
Mm-hmm. Chair Helm, point well taken, and I think that is to some degree what I have been saying is that is outside. We didn't look into the range of issues that Representative Benz has been asking about. We scratched the surface on some of them, but there's a lot more there that did fall outside the scope of our study and what we were asked to look at, too.
Right. And I will say, before I call on Rep. Johnson, that just speaking for myself, this is why I'm sacrificing my Tuesday evenings to help get these questions out, because they are many. I mean, Rep. Benz is absolutely right. We cannot go into something this important and this far-reaching without getting our questions answered up front. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Colin, what I'm hearing, and I don't want to put words in your mouth as you respond to Rep. Benz, is that on these difficult questions of how to proceed and questions that we may not know the answer for, we're going to be calling up the California Air Resources Board. And I frankly don't know how many of my constituents are comfortable having them write an energy policy for the state of Oregon, but outside, who else would you turn to? I mean, they've got a plan. You could turn to Quebec, but ultimately they're the cheerleaders for this as part of the Western Climate Initiative and so forth. We know that. That's the nexus. So, I mean, I wish there was another option, but I'm not hearing of one. And DEQ, I don't think, has anyone in-house that could provide that sort of expertise or has that kind of experience, because there's just frankly aren't that many out there. So that's fine to say that, but I just wanted to get that out there that I don't know that my constituents or how many other legislative districts would be comfortable just saying we're going to turn our climate policy over to the state of California.
We are not. I can assure you, Representative, we are not going to do that. I personally have no interest in, you know, we in all sorts of areas learn from California. They make mistakes just as we make mistakes. Yeah. And hopefully we can learn from our mistakes, but I know that we can learn from their mistakes. But It is a very legitimate point, and I think I would echo Rep. Helms' point that we need to know when we're at the limit of our expertise and where we need to go look elsewhere, whether it's academia or, you know, other states, other countries, people in industry. There are consultants now who do this work. I think there's a rich array of resources, and we need to be prepared to call on them. So, Colin, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Moving on to that next area of consideration I identified earlier, that is allowance distribution. As I mentioned, the state issues allowances into the system. This is how the cap is enforced, essentially, is that those sources of emissions covered by the cap are required to retire allowances equal to their amount of emissions. So they must acquire somehow allowances to cover their emissions. And so how the state distributes these allowances becomes a very important part of the program. And when you really boil it all down, there's essentially two different ways that the state has to issue allowances into the system. And perhaps the simplest one for the state is to auction them off. As I note there, this requires no state formula for distribution, meaning that we're in the business as at the state of determining who gets the allowances and in what quantity. Instead, by auctioning them off, we are distributing the allowances to the entities that are most willing to pay for the continued ability to emit greenhouse gases. Auctioning also, it brings a couple noteworthy benefits. The first one listed there is that it sends a clear price signal, because entities covered by the program, as well as outside observers for that matter, can more clearly see what the price is to emit by seeing what the clearance price is at auction. What are these allowances actually auctioning for? Then the last bullet there underneath auction, the generation of revenue, it proves also to be a really important benefit of this distribution technique, because that revenue then becomes a tool by which to mitigate some of those effects that I mentioned, or considerations that I mentioned earlier, such as the effects on low-income households and on rural communities. Nonetheless, the alternative mechanism for distributing allowances, which is to freely allocate them directly to entities covered by the program, does offer one benefit in particular worth noting, which is probably obvious, that by freely allocating allowances to regulated parties, the state is defraying the cost of acquiring those allowances for those parties. And this ends up being perhaps the most significant tool to mitigate that leakage effect I mentioned earlier. So the state can identify businesses that are at most risk of leakage, those businesses that are energy intensive and exposed to trade pressure or competitors outside the state that are not subject to a program like this. Those energy intensive and trade exposed businesses could be recipients of free allowances to offset that leakage pressure that could otherwise arise.
So. Senator Rowe.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
So I want to go back a little bit to Bence's question because of this. So our state decides that we have cement manufacturer, large energy, we're going to give free allowances because we need to keep that company. I'm going to now join this other group. Are they going to accept my free allowances? What's the negotiations that's going to happen between entities based on what we price our carbon at and what we decide to do in free allowances, the 15% to 17% that are not in it? All of those things have to be a part of the negotiations for the other group to let us come in. That's really complex stuff, and it's really expensive kinds of stuff. And if we set a price and it's not in conjunction with their price, are they going to want us to be in there if we have cheap carbon as opposed to what kinds of information do we need to have to be in a even stand in negotiating how we get into this arrangement with other states to balance all those kinds of things? Because we may have a different idea of what we think should be a free allowance than that they have. I hope that does a little bit of what you were asking.
Chair, Senator Roblin, yes, there is some consideration for linkage here. My understanding from informal discussions with staff in those jurisdictions is that there is quite a bit more flexibility in how an individual jurisdiction decides to issue allowances relative to that stringency issue that I mentioned earlier, which is where parity really needs to be sought. Here, there is likely flexibility, but it is, as you alluded to, really a discussion between those jurisdictions. I mean, the issue being that if, taking your example of cement manufacturer, if, let's just say, California has decided that their cement manufacturers are not at risk of leakage, and are, I don't think this is not an accurate example, but a hypothetical one. They have, if they have chosen not to issue free allowances to their cement manufacturers, and Oregon, there may be flexibility there for Oregon to diverge from that, but I think that would be an ongoing discussion with them, out of concern that that would could just be essentially, you know, shift cement manufacturers from down there in California to up here in Oregon, where yes, they're still covered by the program, but they get free allowances. There could be some just interstate competitiveness issues there.
And follow up. And so, to me, that's the issue about who do we go to? Who's the experts that can? A, we're in this big market, and when you're in big markets, everybody's looking to find their best advantage. And my feeling has been a lot of times Oregon gets left out, and we don't take advantage of what we may have to offer or not. And so who is it that's out there that could help us with that? I know that most of the people that are doing this, whether it's Quebec, whatever, have good intentions, and they want everything to be nice. But at the end of the day, how do we protect the values that we want to keep in Oregon in any of those kind of negotiations? And who do we start looking for to start giving us some of that information?
Chair, Senator Roblin, one of the these are questions we asked in the course of our study, and what we found there is that this area in particular around issuance of free allowances to control leakage is one that is in need of ongoing work and study, not just at the outset of the program, but continuing into implementation. And that so the kind of soft recommendation, if you read this part of the study, really from us, is to provide for the flexibility to make adjustments on an ongoing basis to monitor, you know, how effective is the allowance distribution at controlling leakage, and really, like I say, be able to make those adjustments on an ongoing basis. Because I think what we've seen looking at California is they continue to monitor this closely as well, because I think everyone can agree, to no matter what side of the issue on cap and trade you fall, that this is a serious issue to control. So
thank you.
And I'm going to call on Rep. Helm, but before, just to remind you that our hope is that next week we'll be in conversation with the ministers, ideally, of both Quebec and Ontario, and we can ask them these questions, and maybe we'll actually ask them in advance to be thinking of this, sort of what process did they go through as they were trying to figure out the best path to alignment. I think that I'd like to hear directly from them on this. Yes.
Colin, can you give us some examples from your study of, of California's program where they have given credits away to certain, not individual companies, but sectors?
Chair Helm, just to clarify, these free allowances are going to individual companies, but the determination, I think maybe this is what you intended, but they make the determination not on a company by company basis, but on a sector basis.
Give us some examples of that, so that we have something to chew on.
Yeah, I think food processing is one of them. Pulp and paper maybe is another. I suspect that Sean, with his knowledge of the California system, can give more examples, honestly, than I can. I
don't know, Sean. Go ahead, Sean. Then.
No, I think he's named the main ones. Transportation is.
Sean, why don't you introduce yourself for the record?
Sean Penrith, Executive Director of the Climate Trust. So food processing, industrial facilities have also been granted a phased-in free allowance allocation. Transportation sector was added in 2015. It also has a phased allocation of allowances.
We hear a lot about cement. What's the deal on cement?
Whether it was Chair Helm, are you asking whether cement has been considered a leakage risk? I would have to get back to you on it to confirm. My suspicion is that it is also a phased-in recipient, but I would want to confirm that.
Can I add? There's a term that they use, which is EITE, which is Energy Intensive Trade Exposed Industries. Cement is an EITE sector.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, Colin. Carry on. But this is exactly what we
right,
want.
I hope.
To do.
I mean, yeah. Another one. Pulp and paper. That's an EIT. Yeah. That's also an exposed.
Right.
It meets the same requirements, basically. So that was
one
just.
We have to watch, too.
Yeah.
Yes, Chairs, Senator Roblin, I believe so. Yes. And I should just note that this. We looked at specifically at which sectors in the California market are have been labeled energy intensive and trade exposed and lined those up with the sectors that exist here in Oregon's economy so that this is noted there. I can absolutely, if there are specific questions such as on cement, refer back to that and get that information to the committees.
Great. Thank you.
I think that's everything here on this slide on allowance distribution. Okay. So moving on to what's obviously another key consideration for a program like this, revenue. To the extent the program is auctioning allowances, that means there's revenue being generated. And what we assumed in the course of this study, having looked at the issue a little bit with our Department of Justice, is that the revenue. We're not certain of this, but we have good reason to believe that the revenue generated from the auction of allowances to cover emissions from transportation fuels is likely subject to Oregon's constitutional restriction on fees and taxes levied on transportation fuels. And such that revenue, that auction revenue, would likely have to go be constrained to funding the maintenance, operation, and construction of roads and bridges across the state. Any remaining revenue, though, we didn't identify any other restrictions that would likely be in place. So the remaining revenue would be at the discretion of legislature to determine how that was spent. That said, we did identify a few uses that would make sense in the context of a program like this. And the first one listed there is using some of that revenue to directly benefit those disadvantaged and rural communities because of the issues I noted earlier about the different ways that those households and businesses in those parts of the state would experience a program like this. Revenue from auctioned allowances can also be used to mitigate any increase in cost to utility ratepayers, and I think Jason will cover this in a little more detail. The third item listed under there is to use the revenue to further emission reductions. We see a lot of that in the California systems where essentially revenue can be used to either reduce emissions that are covered by the cap and thereby lower the allowance cost, basically make the program cheaper, or it can extend the reach of the program by reducing emissions from sources that are not covered by the cap. So we looked at this in some detail as far as around those considerations the legislature identified, but it is important to note that we really didn't cover the full range of options, of course, that the legislature could use this revenue, just noting that aside from the transportation restriction, any other revenue would likely be spent at the discretion of legislature.
Colin, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I have heard in my conversations with California legislators different concerns about what the revenue is being used for and different stories about when it worked well and when it didn't. Did you pick up on any of that? Can you give us some examples from your research I'm not asking you to make a call on what was a good idea and what was not, but just tell us what you may have seen and heard in your research.
Chair Helm, I think one thing that jumps to mind immediately is that first bullet there. That what we see in California is increasing. What we heard there is that there's been over recent years increasing interest from the minority communities and low income communities in California to really be the direct recipients and beneficiaries of at least some of that revenue. And there have been new legislation. And adjustments to that program to assure that certain portions of the revenue are spent directly in those communities and that directly benefit those households and businesses in those communities. So just, I guess I'm observing that that appears to be a growing issue and consideration there in California.
Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I think as you talk about revenue and talk about California, I think it's important to take a current events look at that. But, you know, I've got a headline here from the March 1st Sacramento Bee that says California cap and trade carbon auction, another big washout. Mm-hmm. And they're referring to this is the third, I think, in the last quarterly sales that they can't sell the thing. So they have, you know, the legislature had hoped that they would have this cash stream to pay for things like a bullet train and so forth, and the money is not coming in. So I'm just saying, hypothetically, theoretically, yes, that could be a revenue stream, but you have to actually, the market, if the marketplace doesn't respond and doesn't want what you have to sell, you don't have that. So just one, there's multiple, you know, quick little Google search here can provide a lot of information about what actually is happening in real time in California. So I think that's important to get on the right.
Let me ask a question as a follow-up to that, though, because I agree that that's happening, but, and maybe one of our panelists can answer this, my understanding is that the current litigation challenging the system as a tax has chilled participation. So can any one of you confirm that I heard the right thing or not?
Yeah, this is actually the fifth time the auction has been undersubscribed.
Right.
The two driving elements behind it, one is the Kell Chamber lawsuit brought against ARB by a food processing entity called Morningstar, which contests the legality of auctioning the allowances. And the second thing is whether or not post-2020 there will be a cap-and-trade program. And so when covered entities surrender and acquire allowances, they have to do so by vintage. And so as we approach the 2020 sunset, the enthusiasm for acquiring offsets post-2020 diminishes, leading to a bid ratio of 0.18. So you're absolutely right.
Let me ask, sorry to be, so I have so many questions, but go back to some of the early rounds in California and tell us about that, because I want to understand how much the lawsuits chilled participation.
Jahelm, there was a precipitous drop in the engagement. So you went from 99 to 100% subscription. There's been 10 auctions in total. Five have been undersubscribed. Five were 95-plus subscribed. So very healthy engagement, and the prices all cleared at the floor.
I'm sorry, Colin. Yes, Brett,
yeah.
Marsh.
Thank you. Does some of that undersubscription reflect a lack of need for those permits? I mean, are we actually reducing the need for the emission permits?
Representative Marsh, no. I would say that there is. It's just a question of prudence as to whether covered entities want to be holding the bag come 2020 when there is no post-2020 program. They are relying on the fact that if the right signal is received that there is a post-2020, they will go to market and buy bilaterally or spot. So they're withholding the option of capital outflows, essentially.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Moving on to cost containment, and this was an issue. One thing I didn't cover here that I did a couple weeks ago is comparing cap and trade to a carbon tax, which actually raises some key distinctions between the conversations we were having just now on revenue, where one of the two main distinctions between a tax and a cap and trade program is that a cap and trade program provides you with certainty over the emissions outcome, that you're assured that emissions will not exceed the overall limit so long as you have faith in the enforcement and monitoring of the program. but you don't have certainty over the revenue and over the price that's being set by the program. Where it contrasts that with the tax, where it's just flipped around, where you don't, where you do know what the price is going to be because you're setting it, you're setting the tax, but you don't know what the response to that price will be, and thus you don't know what the amount of emissions will be reduced. So that raises the issue in a market system like this, where the state is not establishing what the price will be, at least with any precision. And in fact, that's the point of the program, is to let the market determine what the value of the ability to continue to emit is. Nonetheless, there's reasons to want to contain that volatility or contain how much the price can fluctuate over time. And there are a number of ways to do this, and we see many of these mechanisms in place in the WCI programs. And I would note that a lot of these elements these are also elements that would need to align with those WCI jurisdictions for linkage. So as I run through these, I'll note where there might be some options. But for the most part, these do need to be closely aligned. The first one there is banking, and that just refers to the ability for an entity to hold on to allowances between compliance periods. Right now, compliance periods are 3 years in the WCI system, and there's a provision for unlimited banking. There's no limit to the amount of allowances that can be held in perpetuity, really. And that allows for businesses to basically have if they have surplus allowances, they can be used in later years, and that can help moderate price increases. The second one listed there, linkage, actually really is also a price containment mechanism. It can by linking jurisdictions and having a broader and deeper economy that's covered by the program, that broader economy is less volatile itself, and thus less likely to produce a less volatile response to this market policy. So linkage in and of itself, it helps to moderate price and helps to contain cost volatility. Price floor, as Sean mentioned just a moment ago, that's the minimum price which the state has said it would be willing to auction allowances. Right now, I think it's at just about $13 right now in the WCI system. So if when we talk about an undersubscribed auction, to some degree, we know that. I back up. We know that bids cannot come in at an amount below that floor price. That would not be accepted by the jurisdiction. So that helps assure a minimum value there of allowances. A price ceiling is the kind of the opposite. Depending on how firmly it would be implemented, it can provide a maximum price that allowances would sell for. And what we see here in the WCI jurisdictions is essentially a soft ceiling. It does not provide an absolute cap on what allowances will sell for, but it does provide basically an influx of a moderating signal should prices exceed a certain amount. And what we see and how that's done in this case in the WCI system is that the jurisdictions have an allowance reserve, a reserve of allowances that the jurisdiction withholds from auction unless the price exceeds a certain amount, and at which point then a reserve auction is held and additional allowances are issued into the system with the hope that those additional allowances will moderate the price, and so the price shouldn't go much beyond that trigger price, that auction reserve trigger. And then finally, I list here offsets here under cost containment. They're a much more significant tool than simply cost containment, and I think Sean's going to cover them in more detail. That's why I kind of just listed them here and don't have a slide separately covering the many facets of offsets. Offsets, as I think I've mentioned, are essentially offset credits are another compliance instrument separate from allowances, but that can be used in the same way. They represent a ton of emissions that have been reduced through an eligible program, a program that has gone through the WCI system, fairly rigorous protocols to assure that that project is really representing additional emission reductions that have been achieved solely because as a result of that project, and thus the offset credit associated with it represents real emission reductions. And so those credits can be turned in, much like an allowance, to cover an entity's emissions. and that helps moderate price. In the context of this slide, offsets are helping to moderate price by extending the availability of compliance instruments to include these, to the extent there are projects available at or below the allowance price, they should be economic and be producing compliance instruments, in this case, offset credits that can be used as well by regulated parties. And I should note here that the WCI has a restriction on, or how the California program, which I'm most familiar with, works, is that there's a restriction on the usage of offsets, that any entity can use no more than 8% of its overall emissions. I'll explain that differently. An entity can cover up to 8% of its emissions with offset credits, but no more than that. So 92% or more of an entity's compliance instruments must be allowances.
An entity, you mean a company?
Or a company, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Senator Roper.
So I'm trying to get that one kind of in my mind. So could a real estate group that's going to build a large building, build a building, we have people now in the state that are building buildings that have zero emissions. The common one has emissions, but they do all the different kinds of things to make that building adding no carbon to the deal. Could they get offsets? They're not in necessarily one of the groups that are being dealt with, but could they, because they've shown that they are using techniques that actually reduce carbon, could they get offsets that they could then sell to other entities who are in the group?
Chair, Senator Roblin, great question. For the most part, I'd have to go back and think about the many aspects of a building's emissions and whether some of those emissions are coming from sources that are not covered by the program. But for the most part, a building's emissions are coming from at least
electricity
that or on-site combustion of fuels. These are sources of emissions that are covered by the cap and trade program, at least as the right. models that we've looked at. And one of the primary tenets of an offset is that it must be coming reducing emissions that are not covered by the program.
Oh, okay.
I didn't mention that.
It's an incentive.
Okay.
Yeah.
So agriculture, other places.
Precisely.
Could then come up with a. So that's where you could look at things like non-till what stuff and all those kinds of things to get offsets that can be helpful to you.
Precisely, Chairs Senator Roblin. I think the agriculture and forestry sectors are the prime examples of where most of the offsets that have been generated in the WCI system reside.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, Rappel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea of Ontario and Quebec's appetite for offsets that are being offered in California? Is that am I right in assuming that's the direction that the offset market would be going, that Canada's buying some sort of project or conservation easement type of thing in California?
Sure, how much? I think that is, to some degree, what Sean may be covering here in the experience of these other markets. And so I can't speak directly to that.
We can come back to the offset.
Okay, great.
Okay, I think this is my last slide here. Program administration. This isn't exactly like the other slides here, where it's not necessarily a facet of the program design so much, but I know it's we nonetheless identified it as an important part of the program to think about how would we actually administer this, since particularly at my agency, assuming we were the agency tasked with much of the implementation, what are the main moving parts here as far as how this program would run? And many of the components listed here could be shared at any rate with WCI jurisdictions if we were linked into that system. The first of which is the allowance tracking system. So this is just as it sounds, this system for tracking allowances that the state would use once it auctions or hands over allowances to an entity, tracking it if it is subsequently traded, and ultimately to the point at which it's retired in the system, meaning that it was turned in to cover an entity's emissions. That's obviously a fundamental component of the program, and there's a system already being used by WCI jurisdictions that we would presumably be able to use as well if we were linked in with that system. Compliance verification That is something that would likely reside, mostly here in Oregon. We would be responsible for assuring compliance, meaning chiefly that entities covered by the program do in fact turn in allowances in sufficient quantity to cover their emissions. So that relies heavily on a reporting system where those entities report their emissions to DEQ, and we monitor and verify that they are accurately reporting those emissions, and subsequently monitor and verify, or separately monitor, that they are turning in allowances in sufficient quantity to cover those emissions that they're reporting to us. The auction platform is that's again just as it sounds, the software platform that is used to auction, to hold it, to conduct the auction, and that is also something that we would be able to use if we linked in with the WCI system. We would use that common auction platform. I believe right now California and Quebec hold joint auctions, and so that is at least a potential option, if not a likelihood, that the auctions could be held jointly between whichever jurisdictions are linked. A market monitor is something that I think both we as the state would want to do some of this ourselves, but also I think reliant on the third party that the WCI Inc. contracts with to monitor the market, to make sure there's no errors and no nefarious gaming of the market by actors, basically to really assure that the market is functioning in a healthy manner, and keeping a close eye on both the auction itself, the secondary markets that result for the buying and selling of allowances, as well as comparing what's going on in that allowance market with other external markets like the fuels market or other energy markets, and just making sure that any spikes or dips or things that are going on in this market appear rational and understandable, and if not, looking into why that might be.
Excuse me, Rep. Helm.
How does California work that? Who for the market monitor in California, is that a separate governmental agency? Is it a third party of some sort, a watchdog? And how are they? How is that funded?
Chair Helm, it is a third party, and it is funded, as I say, the contract is through WCI Inc., and WCI Inc. itself is funded by the member jurisdictions.
A follow-up on that is, do you know what the mechanism is for funding them? Is it a small surcharge on is it a carve out, or is it a fee? Is it a membership? How would we think about that?
Chair Helm, good question. I believe it is, as I say, it's funded through WCI Inc., which receives its money, as I understand it, through payments from those member jurisdictions. So Quebec and California and are paying WCI Inc. certain quantities of money. I don't know what those, how much money goes into WCI Inc. Or how much that goes to this third party that's contracted for the market monitor. But those are numbers we can dig up and provide.
Yeah, and just to follow up, and so presumably they use revenue from the revenues generated by the program, or do they use general fund dollars? That would be useful for us to know.
Chair Denver, I will include that in the information we provide back to you. Okay, and then the last bullet listed there, just worth noting that the new staff will be required to administer this program. I doubt that comes as any surprise, but noting there some of the functions necessary at a very high level to run this program. Obviously, developing the program design and going through the rulemaking, those will be significant endeavors, as well as the stakeholder engagement that we undoubtedly would have to go through as well as part of that program design and rulemaking. And just to note as well that the existing greenhouse gas reporting program that we have here in Oregon already at DEQ would likely need to be expanded and bolstered essentially to provide some of that additional monitoring and verification that I already mentioned, just to support the program. And I think that's the end of my slides. I'm going to hand it over here to Jason Eisdorfer.
Okay. Before you do, any more questions for Colin? Okay, thank you. All right, Jason, tell us how this all looks from a commission perspective.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, Chair Helm, members of the committees. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. I have four slides. We'll see how long it takes to get through those four. And I'm going to speak for a couple of minutes about how the cap and trade would interact with the Public Utility Commission's regulation of the investor-owned utilities. So as a matter of a quick reminder, and I think some of you have seen a lot of this before, but all else being equal, this isn't going to change even if a cap and trade were adopted. Public Utility Commission regulates three investor-owned electric utilities in the state, Portland General Electric, Pacific Corp, and Idaho Power, and the three natural gas utilities in the state, Northwest Natural, Cascade, and Avista. So this slide really represents two core regulatory activities of the commission. The first is rate making, and that is the ultimate point of oversight. The investments made must be prudently incurred and be used and useful for the utility customer. The rate case is an extensive 10-month process, has multiple multiple parties as interveners, and those rate cases look at capital investments and expenses to determine what the just and reasonable rates ought to be. The second core principle there is the integrated resource plan. This is least cost, least risk basis. This is analysis is looking at the customer needs over a 20-year period and a 5-year action plan. It also looks at the legal, environmental compliance obligations that a utility would have, so that would be baked into the assumptions in an integrated resource plan. And while the commission doesn't have, according to the DOJ opinion, doesn't have the authority to put into rates the cost of environmental damage from utility actions for, oh, I'd say 15 years, and certainly the last 10 years, the commission has required the utilities in their integrated resource plans to go and analyze and account for the risk of potential future regulatory action, statutes or regulations, and then model a range of potential carbon costs to determine which set of activities and portfolios hang best with those assumed carbon regulations. So there is baked into those into that IRP an assumption that, or not maybe an assumption, but the possibility that there should be carbon costs in the future. And again, all else being equal, these aren't going anywhere. And this will come back a little bit when we talk about the cap and trade and how it interacts with the regulatory policies. So I'm going to go through. We picked three policies to discuss how this might interact with a cap and trade. I'm going to start with energy efficiency. You might have heard me say before that cost-effective energy efficiency is always the first resource. It is the resource of choice. It is always less expensive to invest in avoiding energy use up to the cost of acquiring the next unit of energy. So that's where we sort of that's where we start. For Portland General Electric and Pacific Corp, the Energy Trust is assigned to acquire all cost-effective energy efficiency. And that is through the two bills, Senate Bill 1149 and Senate Bill 838. Besides being the least cost resource, energy efficiency also reduces load and therefore the need to generate electricity, including electricity from fossil fuel generation. A carbon price would increase the amount of cost-effective energy efficiency because the price that you're comparing that energy efficiency to generally has gone up. So there's more room to invest. So under a cap and trade, energy efficiency really serves two masters. One is carbon emission reduction, and the other is least cost path forward. And so it really would be the priority resource with or without cap and trade. The next one is the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and I think you all probably remember in 2007 the legislature passed the RPS with a 25% of load served by renewable energy by 2025. And then last year, the legislature extended that to 50% by 2040. So this is a generally a defined a five-year trajectory upwards in terms of percentages. So it's on a reliable schedule. And this actually goes both ways. And if you were to marry the RPS with a cap and trade. So on the one hand, studies do indicate that a cap and trade would mimic an RPS in terms of developing renewable energy. Renewables would be put on the grid to reduce those carbon emissions. Again, with a carbon price, you would be looking out at the kinds of resources the utility would be acquiring. You're looking at a renewable resource and its capital costs, but no fuel costs. And then you would compare that potentially to a natural gas combustion unit, which has your both capital costs and your gas costs, which now have a carbon price associated with it. However, it is possible that under a cap-and-trade, a utility could react to the cap-and-trade's declining emission mandate in the short and medium term by moving from coal to natural gas, and an RPS on top of the cap-and-trade would basically guide the utility toward this renewable path rather than simply doing a wholesale shift from coal to gas. RPS would say you have this trajectory of renewables that you have to meet. On the other hand, it's arguable. I've seen some white papers, at least, that would say that a rigid renewable energy renewable portfolio standard schedule wouldn't allow the cap and trade to find the least cost path toward emission reductions. Because you're sort of hardwiring renewables in rather than letting the genius of the market and the cap and trade find the least cost reductions. But ultimately, I think if you thoughtfully put together a cap and trade and a RPS, they could work together to guide the utility to make the right kinds of resources. And then finally, the electric vehicles. So I do want to say this one is not quite like the others. This is not, at this point, a defined regulation, regulated activity like the energy efficiency or renewables looks like. And at this point, EVs, the energy or the electric vehicle program, is really not an investment made for the grid because of the small amount of EVs that are on the system. But in aggregate and over time, it is really possible that EVs connected to the electricity system could provide an ability, a tool to integrate variable renewable energy. So real quickly, there are three aspects of the EV program that the commission is currently looking at. The first one is from 1547, which required the utilities to propose transportation electrification investments. And the PUC is currently reviewing those filings. The utilities made them at the close of 2016. We're looking at those proposals. In addition, the commission is also has a rulemaking going on that would require the utilities to produce five-year plans, transportation electrification plans. And the concept there is that we really wanted the utilities to think carefully about how to optimize the various programs together to move that market. And then finally, my staff is preparing a memo to the commission, probably to be dealt with in April, to open up an investigation on how the utilities participate in the Clean Fuels Program and potentially how to use any credits that might come back to the utility as a result. So there's a lot going on. None of these are hardwired or even, frankly, traditional aspects of utility regulation. But clearly that is where markets tend to be moving. And so we're learning and we're with the utilities and with our partners at the stakeholders. And coupled with a cap and trade and the Clean Fuels Program, the utility could more easily and economically make investments in electric vehicle infrastructure and market growth. the cap and trade would create a price signal. This would tend to move transportation participants to EVs. As they move to the EVs, if the utility were connected to the clean fuels program, the utility could also be the aggregator and receive credits from the clean fuels program. So this could then be recycled back in. And one of the theories there, as EVs move to the electric sector, they're increasing the load. Utilities are going to have to respond and serve that load. And through the clean fuels program, as more EVs come to pass, the utility could be the recipient of these credits and reinvest those credits. There's a lot of ways that those credits could be spent, either given back to those folks who invested in EVs and charging infrastructure, or investing in greening the system even further, the electricity system. Okay, so this is a little bit of a summary of how that interaction works. There are a number of other policies that I haven't mentioned that I won't go into, but the sum of all of the ones I've talked about and these additional policies could achieve much of the cap and trade's emission reduction goals, depending upon the stringency that Colin was talking about. However, I think it is also fair to say that the policies that we implement right now act independent of each other. The Commission, for the most part, does try to understand these as a totality and as a whole, and try to find the interactions and those linkages. But a lot of these policies are sort of accreted over time, and arguably those policy goals are different or not stated necessarily by the legislature, and weren't necessarily be designed to be interactive, and so they frequently will hang out all by themselves. The third bullet there talks about the price signal. That is a price signal that would be sent to the utility when it goes out into the market to purchase electricity. The price signal could also flow to the customer, and at a minimum, a form of education about the internalizing the cost of the electricity that they're using. And also the cap and trade could serve as an emission reduction backstop to the extent that the other policies didn't produce what they were expected to produce. And then finally, down at the bottom there, one of the intents of any cap and trade that's multi-sector is the intent to connect sectors of the economy that haven't been connected with regard to carbon reduction. And one that bears much promise is the pairing of the transportation and the electric side. And so there's pretty high potential for pretty efficient emission reductions by moving from gas-powered vehicles to electric vehicles and then cycling through, so you're constantly greening the electricity system at the same time, so it's a positive feedback loop. And again, it's a combination of utility regulation, the clean fuels program, and the cap and trade working together to move that market. And finally, the investor-owned utilities will continue to have the Public Utility Commission oversight. We will continue to look at their planning over time, how they would meet the mandates of the cap and trade on a least cost, least risk basis. So that's not going anywhere either. Neither is the rate case, the rate making, and make sure that those kinds of investments are prudent. The utility is a market actor. In some ways, it's very much like any other market actor in a cap and trade. They are sometimes in the market buying, sometimes in the market selling. The difference in this case is that there is a regulator making sure that there are sort of prudent acts along the way. And then finally, the last bullet is the one where I'm going to address some of the pretty quickly some of the issues that Colin raised about the potential tools that the legislature could use to regulate, I suppose, or mitigate any potential cost increases to electric utility customers. And the theory is, as you've seen in some of the other regulations, utility customers are generally and largely always paying for other kinds of policies that tend to get us a long way toward the cap and trade. And so in that sense, I think there's a sort of a legitimate argument that part of the design of the cap and trade sees revenue coming back to the electricity customer to defray and mitigate those costs. I think there's a pretty decent argument anyway that you leave the price signal, even at the customer level. But there's a couple of different ways, either allocation of free allowances to the utility so that the utility's costs don't actually go up all that much, and so their customers' rates don't go up that much. Or Colin also mentioned the idea of the auction option where the utility is given basically a chunk of the revenue comes back to the utility, and through the Public Utility Commission, that value then gets redistributed back down to the customer level. So this is sort of one sector where I think that you can still sort of have a price signal on your bill, but on a monthly or annual basis, your additional costs get significantly mitigated. So that finishes my presentation, and it finishes the slide deck that Colin and I had.
Patriots, I'm going to your third bullet there. It's also possible that some of the allowance revenue could be used to do even more with energy efficiency or do more with technological investments that could lead to, I mean, the rates might be going up, but as you say, the usage could go down because everything's more efficient. There's less waste, better storage, smarter devices, things like that, right?
Chair Dembrow, that's exactly right. Obviously that's a design call at the legislative level, but with the assumption that cap and trade is sort of this declining cap over time, the utility and the regulator know that at some point they have to keep acquiring additional carbon emission reductions. And so by taking a percentage off the top, reinvesting that in you mentioned a couple of them. You could reinvest them in some of the classic energy efficiency renewables, but there are other technologies that we're working with right now and trying to work our way through: storage, smart grid, making sure that demand response is working very well. And all those things tend to make the grid more efficient, the utility fewer emissions, because ultimately that cap is a downward trajectory, and so you're reinvesting some of that money back into the efficiency of the system.
And potentially then less cost to the customer if done right, or at least no higher cost.
Exactly.
Is it your sense, and it seems to be your sense, that the statutory charge of the PUC wouldn't need to change at all under a cap and trade system? That is, you don't need to have the legislature changing your mission per se, but just the fact that a cap and trade system were in place would require you to plan for that, plan for those requirements.
So, Chair Dembrow, there's a couple of different areas I think where let me try to answer that. The first answer is you are correct that the core, there's nothing in cap and trade that fundamentally would change what the commission is doing at this point. I think the commission would in fact oversee a couple of aspects of it. One is if depending upon the design of it, if revenues came back to the utility to be used to mitigate customer rates, you can be sure that it will be used to mitigate customer rates. I mean, that's part of the oversight that the commission would deliver. So I think you could feel pretty safe in that regard. In addition, I think through the integrated resource planning and through the commission process, we would have a thoughtful process. IRPs are very much of a dialogue between the regulator, the utility, and stakeholders to try to figure out how to get to that least cost and least risk place 5 and 10 years down the road. And given your cap and trade trajectory, I think that becomes part of that whole integrated resource plan. But let me sort of end by saying it would also make the commission's job much easier in one very important way. So while we have a number of policies and we love implementing them, and I wouldn't trust them to anybody's staff other than mine, no offense, and they're really quite interesting. The truth of the matter is that a cap and trade would create a price signal on day one. It would create a price signal that the utilities would have to respond to. And that's not something the commission actually has to do. It's just something that comes naturally from that program.
Thank you. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason, I wanted to go back to something, one of the first two slides. The first is that the IOUs, at least in the Integrated Resources Plan, already are required to, or they already are anticipating price on carbon type of issues. If I'm right in what I heard, then my question is, what are they saying so far? Is there a theme to what they're saying so far about how they might react?
Chair Helm, so let me correct your impression a little bit. So we've asked them to do a range of analyses. So their range could go from $0 to $100 a ton. So, I mean, so they, and then they run, then they, so they'll pick several scenarios like that. And there'll be multiple versions in between. And they'll pick several scenarios like that. And then they will pick a couple of different portfolios of resources. And they will test those individual portfolios against different different carbon prices. Mm-hmm. And through that exercise, it will tend to determine which are sort of most durable and stable. I'm just using this as a rough example. If you had a portfolio of a bunch of coal plants that might look relatively inexpensive early on, but as you tested them against carbon prices, you would discover that they don't work very well in medium or high carbon price futures, and so you score that one not 100%, right? And so some of these portfolios would have wind in it and maybe a natural gas plant, and you do the same thing with that. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up at the end of that process is a preferred portfolio that works well over multiple carbon scenarios.
Good. That's very helpful. The second question I had is I thought that there was a suggestion that there might be, if we were to adopt a carbon pricing system, that there would be a chance to integrate that system with our existing renewable portfolio standards. What's your impression of what that would look like? What would the integration look like?
Chair Helm, we wouldn't have to do much. I think the bigger question in my mind, I sort of set out a couple of a toggle there that I think that the renewable portfolio standard does set out a clear path in terms of renewable build-out. And I think that would serve some value in a cap and trade. The other side of the coin that I've seen in some white papers, at least, is that too stringent of a renewable rollout interferes with what I was calling the genius of the cap and trade to find the least cost carbon reduction. And so they can absolutely work well together, and they should work well together. But I do think some thought goes into the role of RPS in a cap and trade.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, a whole bunch of questions got raised in my head. So we have a lot of independent programs trying to reduce carbon in Oregon. So let's say we have become much more efficient in reduction of carbon than the other partners that are in this consortium. So we're going to set a cap that is going to reduce it probably more than they are. So is there any relationship, and I guess this to the others, between where you are and where you want to go with respect to the other partners in this whole cap and trade situation? So I'm real efficient here and one place, and I put a cap on it, and so now I'm pushing into places that are a lot harder to capture deals from. Other people are up here, and they have some pretty easy ways to get some reductions to cap. Does that make a disadvantage or an advantage to one entity in this group over another?
Great.
Chair, Senator Roblin, I think what you're describing there is actually the mutual reason for linking. Okay. Assuming all parties want to achieve similar reduction goals, if you have one jurisdiction that has a relatively easy path to those goals, linking with other jurisdictions that have relatively more challenging or expensive paths helps that jurisdiction monetize its relative ease to those jurisdictions. And put them differently from the alternative perspective, from the jurisdiction that also wants to achieve similar reductions but has a more expensive pathway, linking provides a more affordable way to still produce the same emission reductions that achieving their goals would do, but they are now linked to a broader system that offers lower cost emission reductions than they would have left by themselves. Does that answer the
question? Yeah. The thing that popped into my mind is that we had done some stuff a long time ago in a totally different realm, healthcare. So we get a reimbursement rate that's much lower than a whole bunch of other states. So it really hurt us in a whole bunch of the conversations about healthcare, because we had already taken care of the things that other people were getting paid to take care of. And it was frustrating to me to watch our reimbursement rate. And I fought with my federal logic delegations, why do we get this rate and Florida gets this rate? Mm-hmm. It was very frustrating. And I just wanted to make sure that I'm not getting into the same thing, joining another group and all of a sudden at a disadvantage because we've done things to reduce carbon to begin with. And I don't want to have to pay a price higher than somebody else did because we entered into that. I hope that makes some sense.
It does. And Chair, Senator Roblin, if I could add, what you just said there reminds me that one of the – we wrestled with that, as stakeholders raised the same sorts of concerns. Oregon's done a lot already. What if we've plucked the low-hanging fruit and we enter a market where other jurisdictions haven't? And at least looking at what exists right now in the WCI system – and this may not be a surprise when you think about it from a certain perspective, those jurisdictions, one thing they all have in common is a fairly rich history of adopting programs to reduce their emissions already. I say that makes sense on one hand because you would kind of expect that of the jurisdictions that have adopted an economy-wide cap and trade program. They also have done a lot of what we're doing.
One could perhaps argue that the longer we wait, the harder it is, right? I mean, it's going to be easier, say, for California. They've been at it longer. Representative Marsh?
Thank you. Jason, question for you. I wrote down your phrase, which I was quite taken with. A price on carbon would send a price signal and serve as an emissions backstop, which is a great image. Of course, there are various ways to put a price on carbon. Today, we've been primarily talking about the cap and trade, but there's also a carbon tax concept out there. Do you think a carbon tax, which is essentially unlimited, would have the same impact?
Chairs, Representative Marsh, same impact. In the regulatory world, it would, yes. I mean, there are a number of differences, obviously, between a tax and the cap and trade and policy choices between them. But I suppose, in one sense, a price signal is a price signal. Mm-hmm. And so if you all designed it right, it would have basically the same impact as a cap and trade.
Okay, what? All right. Representative.
Oh, thanks. I'd like to ask a question, something that keeps occurring to me in your slide on connectivity, where you talked about, our policies don't have much connectivity. We've got a lot of different policies throughout state government, throughout a lot of different agencies. And so I'm sitting here, looking at the PUC, a regulatory body, and the DEQ, a regulatory body as well. and thinking that we also have the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, Department of Forestry, Department of Agriculture, and wondering how this cap and trade system will really work at the, you know, without really redoing that connectivity between all of our programs, I guess, to make sure they're coordinated to achieve the outcomes. And you highlighted that as being an issue, and you know, I'm just sort of trying to understand how the PUC in its role, I understand how cap and trade can exist and the PUC can still do its job, and certainly a DEQ has a huge role in, you know, the regulatory function of emissions. But just wondering how you see the rest of those pieces of the puzzle coming together. As I remember the Clean Power Plan, when it was, you know, something we had to deal with, it wasn't just one agency dealing with it, I guess, is where I'm going. There was the Department of Energy, DEQ, and the PUC working together to do that. Do you see cap and trade as being something that would necessitate that sort of coordination between more agencies?
Chairs, Representative Holby, I'll also let Colin answer this. To a certain degree, yes. To a certain degree, I think in setting up, you know, to the extent that the legislature delegates certain issues, I would imagine that the state agencies would sort of get together and make sure that everything is working right. And, there's good things and bad things to say, I suppose, about a cap and trade. I think one of the good things to say is that by virtue of the fact that it creates a carbon price and it can create connectivity between different sectors and different existing policies. I think there is some degree of coordination and understanding that it would be necessary between the state agencies as that policy was developed, and then once it kicks off, it has some of its own. It creates glue of its own, I think.
Okay, Rep. Bentz, and then we'll have to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Really interesting discussion, Jason. I appreciate the quality of the analysis provided by the PUC, and I'm just wondering if you are doing studies right now on the possibility of the imposition of a cap and trade system, and if so, where are they? If not, why not?
Chairs, Representative Bentz, no, we are not doing it. We are not currently doing an analysis of where the impact of a cap and trade. And I suppose the why not is I think we would wait until we were directed to do so.
Follow up.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've shared with us your opinion on such a system, which I appreciate. But these are complex matters, well suited for the PUC's analysis and her rigor in providing that analysis. So I think you might want to suggest to the commission they might want to get about it. Because I don't want to go through a situation as we did with the coal to clean bill, where it showed up in 30 days, it somehow got passed without what I thought was appropriate analysis, and I don't want to go through that again on something of this incredible import. And just sitting here and firing questions at you is totally inadequate. So, since I know the commissioners, I can call myself, but it'd be great if you could deliver that message.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Bentz, we won't pass this for at least 30 days. I mean, I think it'll probably be at least 60. Really.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. That's plenty of time.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jason.
Sean? Is there any relationship? You, at PUC, you take care of the regulated group of energy producers. There's this other whole group out there of the PUDs and the rural electric cooperatives. Is there... What assurances do we have that this system isn't going to affect them in a way that's so totally different from your regulated groups? And who's out there that can help them or us figure out what the impacts of this kind of a program would be on those people.
Chair, Senator Roblin, I'll take the first crack at it. There should be a difference. The content of the energy that they're providing, I won't say 100% of them, but many of them are from the federal hydro system at Bonneville, and so the carbon content of the energy that they're providing would not be significantly impacted by a carbon price. You know, that creates some. If the investor-owned utilities come and talk to you, that's one of the things actually that they might raise.
Yeah. Okay. I just would add, Chairs, Senator Roblin, it's a good question that we looked into a little bit. In fact, I was actually speaking in front of a group of the rural electric co-ops in Oregon yesterday. About how a program like this might affect them. I would add to Jason's point that because most of these consumer-owned utilities are serving primarily Bonneville hydropower through Bonneville, most of them fall well below that 25,000 metric ton threshold that I mentioned earlier. So they would likely, this is contingent on program design, but I think one reasonable way to design the program would be for them to not be regulated parties at all by the program, which is not to say they would there would be no secondary effects to them to the extent that Bonneville balances their power with market purchases. Market purchases might be a little bit higher, depending on or a lot higher, depending on what the carbon price is. The flip side of that is, though, in years when Bonneville has surplus power, that's power would sell for more as well, because it would have added value of not having carbon in its content. So the value of those sales as it flows back to those utilities could increase in those years with surplus power. So there's some secondary effects to consider.
Great, thank you. Okay, Sean.
Can we switch to mine?
Yeah.
I need to restate my name.
No, we're still under the same.
Okay, great. With deference to your time, I think we're ending at 7:30. So, is this in screen? Is this in display? No. She's got the master.
No.
Did you want me to jump into any one particular area? Because what I was going to cover was challenges of market design and impacts on any one of these systems, but because we haven't got a lot of time, I wanted to make sure it was relevant.
That's a good question.
I am particularly interested in the offsets discussion.
Okay.
That might be jumping quite a bit ahead.
That's okay. I can whip through and just point out the salient market failures and what the lessons were, if that works. All right.
That would be great.
So just a very broad contextual framing.
And let me just say, obviously the members know this, but people who are watching online, these slides are online under meeting materials for this meeting, so they're available for everyone.
Thank you. Under the Paris Agreement, it essentially architected that the 194 signatories to the Paris Agreement could enter into what's known as internationally transferable mitigation outcome trading, which is shorthand for offset and allowance trading. Over half of the signatories included carbon mechanism and carbon pricing in their country plans under the Paris Agreement. 50% of the global CO2 emissions are in play in countries around the world, either planned or an active program, other than the U.S. being one of the largest, one of the 10 largest economies in the world. So this is a very important point. My colleagues have mentioned this, but I just want to reiterate it. The purpose of a cap and trade is not to take care of the carbon certainty for the state of Oregon or any jurisdiction. It is only there to act as an elastic backstop in the event that the models that we deliver for certain sectors, like a renewable portfolio standard or energy efficiency program, if they for whatever fail, as models tend to do, the cap and trade is a backstop that can enter in to provide the certainty that we need. As also mentioned, it gives a cost-effective pathway for least cost compliance. So the European system was a disaster. Despite that, it managed to reduce emissions by 45%, 19%, while the economy grew. The takeaways were essentially twofold. One was there was an over-allocation of allowances, so they did not do the appropriate modeling to closely correlate the amount of allowances that they gave specifically to energy-intensive trade-exposed entities, because they were subject to a lot of lobbying, and the argument of leakage was very prevalent. And so that was a real issue. They also didn't use the consignment model for utilities. Jason talked a little bit about that. That's a very powerful lesson that California learned. The other was the scamming of the offset market, known as the Clean Development Mechanism. So offsets were created in countries where I'm from, South Africa, Latin America. They were not subject to the appropriate review and rigor, and so they were often double-sold or double-counted. So California, for example, took those lessons and has attempted to deliver rigor where an offset is verified essentially three times before ARB will actually release it into the market. And they also have a clawback called invalidation, which means ARB can say, I found something that I don't like, I'm invalidating your offset. So they've attempted to take a lot of these lessons from the EU system. EU also suffered from price implosion. They did not have a price floor, which is why California has a price floor that increases at 5% per annum plus CPI. It also did not have what California attempted to introduce, which is called a cost containment mechanism, which is essentially to put, as Colin mentioned, a soft ceiling on prices. Europe has now come to their senses, and they've introduced or will introduce in 2019 a market stability reserve. It will essentially hold those surplus allowances out of the market to create or constrain the market so the prices go up from cents, literally cents, up to where they should be at around 10 euros a ton. The Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is nine New England states, was the first regional cap and trade system in the country. It only places an emissions cap on the electric sector. Its purpose was very clear when they designed it. It was never meant to be an economic development model. It was simply there to contain emissions to avoid the what they termed as catastrophic cost impacts from a changing climate in their region. Their cap declines at 2.5% per year. They also have an offset provision. You can see the sectors at the bottom here, landfill methane, forestry, energy efficiency, and avoided methane from dairy digesters. It is worth pointing out that not a single offset has been transacted in the RGGI system. And that is because the price of RGGI allowances is so low that it is not economically feasible to produce an offset. So again, we see that California tried to counter this by putting a price floor, and the price floor in California has a spread correlation to the price of an offset. So an allowance in California is now $13.57, and an offset is at around $11. And so because of that, it makes it economically feasible to produce an offset project. They have had pretty interesting results in terms of their reinvestment. They've put around $3 billion into energy efficiency, renewable energy, and other social benefit projects. They've determined an overall health impact of between, well, around $5.7 billion. They've recorded a correlation between a decreasing cap and air quality that has led to improved, depending on how you view it, mortality rates or avoided adult deaths and severe asthmatic conditions. The consumers in the nine states have benefited from savings of electricity of $341 million, and from the gas and heating sector, about $118 million. One of the key things that the researchers found with Reggie, which was initially a big criticism, which was that system reliability would be impacted by putting a price on carbon. And what they found through the nine years that Reggie's been operating is that that has not occurred. They've also benefited from fossil fuel spending because they've not had to import as much fossil fuel into the region as before. It is important, you know, both Reggie and California prior to the implementation of those systems had a lot of detractors come out, and this is one from Americans for Prosperity, which basically predicted a doubling of electricity prices and a number of other negative aspects. Fortunately, that did not happen. We've got economic GDP gain in Reggie. Very briefly, China is going on stream with a national system. They did a seven regional pilot system, which is concluded, and they're launching a national ETS. It will be twice the size of the European system, and their goal is to reach to have a peak of CO2 emission intensity by 2030. Extremely aggressive. So again, the California system, what they wanted to do was ensure that the cap and trade mechanism was not a central plank, but a backstop plank to the other programs that they had, which was the clean cars, they've got the LCFS and the renewable energy standard. And so they essentially relying on those other targeted programs to deliver the bulk of their emissions. The cap and trade is only there to catch around 16% of the emissions in the event one of those programs does not perform. So that's all it's meant to do. It covers 85% of the emission sources. Colin mentioned this earlier. One of the failures of AB 32 and specifically cap and trade, the bulk of the revenue from the auctioning of allowances goes into a greenhouse gas reduction fund. By legislation, the spending of those funds must be directed to an activity that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. They have been reasonably successful at doing that if you classify the bullet train as a lowering of an emission standard. One of the challenges they failed at is targeted reinvestment into the disadvantaged communities. Now, 25% of the GGRF is mandated to be reinvested into disadvantaged communities. But the EJ community is extremely upset because they don't see and realize the tangible effects there. And so Senate Bill 32 and 197 are an attempt in a post-2020 world to put a very, very strong focus on disadvantaged communities and direct reductions at facility sites because they are concerned at the particulate matter contamination. There's air contamination that they don't believe is being addressed. The other amendment in the scoping plan for post-2020 is ARB has called out a natural and working lands approach. That resonates for us in Oregon. We've got about 9.7 billion tons of CO2 equivalent stored in Oregon forests. ARB has recognized that this sector offers tremendous sequestration potential, and so they've amended their scoping plan to have a particular focus on it. Very quickly here, covered entities need to report annually. They can surrender compliance instruments. As Colin said, the compliance instruments are either allowances or they can be offsets, but they're limited at 8% of their compliance obligation. In the world of the offset market, it is important to note that an allowance is essentially the permit to pollute, and an offset is actual one ton of CO2 avoided or reduced. So there is a difference, although they are both termed compliance instruments. The emissions in the covered sectors have declined more rapidly than anticipated. As you can see, this is showing the surrender of the allowances, but it does not reflect the 54 million offset tons or the CO2 equivalent tons that have been delivered by the offset protocols, plural. This graph is helpful in identifying how growth has occurred in California while emissions have gone down. Essentially, the California economy grew at around 6.6% and managed to sustain job growth higher than the national average. So, you know, California and ARB, when they come and tell you, they will say, we have successfully decoupled GDP growth with emission reduction. There has been pass-through effects. Different studies have been done, specifically with an eye to disadvantaged communities. They have found a positive benefit in terms of electric savings, oil and gas savings, and gasoline savings. As I mentioned, there is a targeted reinvestment into disadvantaged communities. That revenue bucket is supposedly going to increase to around $12 to $45 billion by 2025. But again, the purpose of the cap and trade program in California is not to raise revenue. It is to provide GHG certainty. So when there is a lot of concern from market practitioners that the stability of the revenue is not assured, and ARB's argument is that was never the design intent of the program to start with. We mentioned this earlier. There's a lawsuit that's pending that's put a chill on the market. The 2020 regime for cap and trade remains uncertain, and so there's a lot of question as to whether or not we will be trading allowances and offsets. In terms of the uncapped sectors, so just like in Oregon, we have in the pie chart that Colin showed.
I'm just having a hard time getting by that last slide. You mentioned in the first 8 years of AB 32, the petroleum usage decreased by 14%.
Yes.
Having a hard time envisioning that impact. Can you explain how that happens?
Yeah, so the petroleum consumption was largely driven by the low carbon fuel standard, which mandates the carbon content and intensity of fuels, which has put a brake on imported fuels.
And so is there a cost to the consumer, in that equation somewhere?
Yes. In terms of gasoline volatility, gasoline volatility in California is around 4.5% as a result of AB 32, which, according to research, and I didn't do the research, but is in line with national average. But there is definitely a cost at the pump, yes. ARB's approach to both providing cost flexibility to covered entities and also to address uncapped sectors where a regulatory cap and trade program can't reach. They have adopted 6 offset protocols. Just for context, under the Kyoto Protocol in Europe, there were over 36 protocols. California has very slowly introduced 6 protocols. They are very concerned about avoiding the CDM fiasco. So those are the 6 that are there. You can see the bulk of the offsets that are generated come from the forestry sector, followed by ozone-depleting substances and then livestock digesters. So again, if Oregon were to have a program where we could deliver forestry offsets, we would be able to supply those as a compliance instrument. Offsets have represented 54 million metric tons avoided in the U.S., and 16 million credits across 54 projects were developed in project activities, of which 22 were in disadvantaged communities. One of the other pieces that's important is because the offset market is responding to a demand of offsets, we see a lot of private capital coming into the market to fund those projects. Remember, the offset limit is 8%. Over the life of the program, only 4.4% of the offset bandwidth has been used by covered entities. So it's not that covered entities have taken huge leaps to taking advantage of offsets. About half the obligation limit has been used. And that's pretty much by design, because the high emitting facilities in California have tended to gravitate to using offsets as the curve or the cap declines. When the cost of offsets and allowances increases, as that floor increases, the cost of reduction at site is going to hit parity, and those high emitting facilities will start reducing at site, which is the theory behind the cap and trade program. This is just a snapshot of the auction revenues, so $2.2 billion over a two-year period. You can see the high-speed rail was $500 million budgeted. Affordable housing is at $400 million. Low-carbon transportation, $350 million. And low-carbon transit solutions, $365 million. And then energy efficiency, $325 million. That's it. Thank you.
That was very efficient. Sean, thank you very much. Any questions for Sean?
Okay, at the risk of keeping us just a couple more minutes.
What's the magic? You knew this was coming.
What's the magic about 8% as the limit of the offsets?
Well, first of all, the design of the offset limit, the intention from ARB was to actually set that at 4%. And they had EDF, or I shouldn't say that, EDF did a study on cost containment pathways and found that without offsets, a cost of reducing a ton would be $100, and with offsets would be between $10 and $15. The argument in the modeling was that 4% was insufficient to offer the flexibility to covered entities within the time frame of a decreasing cap. And so that's why when Colin talks about how you sort of front load or the trajectory of that cap, it's extremely important to ensure that those covered entities have a pathway to comply. And so ARB ended up moving it to 8%, doubling it. I can't say it's any more scientific than that.
What's the upper end? I mean, why not 12%?
The argument was that would take away from – it would slow the intersection between the inflection point between direct reduction costs and the costs of offsets. And so they wanted to make sure that they didn't have that trajectory too long and too gradual.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I think just to follow up, there have been some pushbacks, especially from the EJ community, about the use of offsets, right?
Correct.
Concerned that – if they're located near a polluting entity, they don't want to create disincentives for that polluting entity to clean up.
Correct, Chair Dimrod. The argument is very succinct from the EJ community, which is that the use of offsets prevents and inhibits direct reductions at a high-emitting facility. In the research, and we are active in that market as an NGO, the argument is not quite the right way around. The reason the high-emitting facilities are not reducing at site as quickly as EJ would like or anyone would like is because of the allowance allocation. If you remove offsets from the equation, and we have asked high-emitting facilities this question directly, if you have no compliance flexibility with offsets, what are you going to do tomorrow? Are you going to reduce at site? Or, and the answer is an obvious one, we'll just buy allowances because the spread between an allowance and an offset is only around 15 to 20%. Mm. And so while the EJ concerns are very valid in terms of high-emitting facilities and contaminant criterion pollutants, it is not the offset piece that is causing it. And we are in dialogue with EJ and the EJAC itself to really have them look at it's the allowance allocation that's the real issue, because the quicker that cap ratchets down to hit the inflection point where cost parity is reached, then you'll have Tesoro and others investing in reductions at site. So,
and yes, Senator. Did I hear right that part of the problem in the EU and the Europe was offset? Too many?
Almost, yes. the allocation of allowances was too generous.
Yeah, okay.
And then the rigor of the offsets that was occurring in projects around the world was lackluster.
Okay. Colleagues, thanks for your patience. You three presenters, this was very, very informative.
Yeah. I
really appreciate it. Hope you'll stay engaged with us.
Okay. Thank you all.
Yeah. So with that, I will close this evening meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources.
And I'll close the House, this meeting of the House Committee on
Energy and Environment. Energy and Environment. The House Committee on